Nice.
Oh no, that means we gotta be our best of behavior. The sirens have started. You are listening to Night Terrors Radio. I am Ash Hamilton, also with Horror Fix, horror-fix.com. I still cannot enunciate horror the way it should be. Sounds like we've got a different show altogether, which probably would lead to better ratings. But tonight, we're doing something a little different. We have author and tour guide. You know, when I think tour guide, I think we're going to go down the annals of history. And I just want to say annals as many times as I possibly can.
Nice.
Can you say it 3 times fast?
No, I can't actually, and I won't even attempt it. No, if I say it 3 times fast, I'll end up getting cited for a sex crime. So we've got Eric Woods with us. Eric Woods is currently scripting. Now, is the book done?
The book is done, yes. It is going to be out October 1st.
Now, and you also are a tour guide.
Yes.
So for those of you who are listening who are outside of Illinois, which I'm guessing is most of my listener base, we are in the Springfield, Illinois area. Now, where is the actual tour? And if you could, give us a brief idea of the tour. We'll get into that later on in the hour. But if you could tell us, like, where the tour is located.
Sure.
Is it currently running? When is it going to run? And sort of what it consists of.
Sure. The Lincoln Ghost Walk, and it runs every Tuesday through Saturday night. And it's basically downtown. Starts out near the Capitol building by the old Lincoln Herndon Law Office. We make our way a little further south, talk a few things about some of the ghostly stories about Lincoln. We finish up over in the old Lincoln neighborhood, and our final stop is right in front of the Lincoln home.
And how long has this been running?
The tour itself has been running for, this is its 14th year. I'm on my second year of being one of the tour guides.
I can't even hold a job for that long. Let alone anything that takes any amount of effort or work, which a job is supposed to. I think I've actually cracked the code now as to why I don't have a job that has spanned over the course of 14 years. So we've got Eric in here. Eric is, look, we've actually got him in the studio. It's nice to actually have somebody in the studio for once. We've had a couple people in the studio that have come, and we don't get it that often because most people that we have are sort of outside the area. But having somebody actually in here is great because that way I can also gauge, like, when jokes fall horribly flat. It isn't just the horrible silence. Like, I can actually see the look of displeasure on Eric's face, which is also great and strangely humbling at the same time.
Right.
So now let's talk for a moment about let's talk about the book, because we're talking about the book. This is almost in a future tense, but not that future tense.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a release date for the book, by the way?
Yeah, October 1st is the official release
date. Okay, so we're real close.
Right.
That's great. And that is of 2019.
Correct.
Okay, my God.
Yeah. Just got to make sure, you know.
Yeah, that could have been a pants shitter.
Oh, yeah.
There for a second, yeah. So let's first of all talk about sort of, I love to do these, like, the genesis of, like, a person's interest.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do the genesis of Eric Wood's career as an author.
All right.
So let's talk about the genesis of you being an author. Like, when did you get the bug? Was something that you've always sort of wanted to do?
Oh,
and,
boy.
Of course, then, you know, actually doing something that's sort of horror-themed, you know, how you began to conceptualize it.
Right. Third grade, actually, is when I just remember an assignment in class was to write a short story, and it was just, I don't even remember, we had to pick... There were three bowls of topics.
This sounds like a
topics.
Catholic deposition all of a sudden.
It was actually a Catholic grade school, to be honest.
Makes sense.
But it wasn't a horror story at first, okay? But I loved the fact, you know, creating a story, writing a story was really cool. But then, you know, by fourth grade, I was introduced to Friday the 13th and all those 80s slasher flicks.
Yeah,
and
all the classics.
And then eventually Stephen King's Pet Sematary. And I just like, yeah, this is what I want to write. So by sixth grade, when we were writing stories every week, I was writing kind of gory slasher horror stories, and even though, again, it was a Catholic grade school, and they were telling me to tone down on the violence, they would still say great you know, imagination, though. Like, oh, cool. So, and I always wanted to...
They lift you before they absolutely crush your soul.
Right, right. They still like the story, but they're like, well, we're kind of a Catholic school. We're trying to, you know, let's keep the gore to a minimum here. It's like, yeah, right. Yeah, whatever.
We'll keep the real trauma behind the scenes.
Right. I had to, yeah, so... But then I would start, I would keep writing short stories, even outside of school. I just loved writing and creating, like, horror stories. And, you know, I'd watch every horror movie that I could back then. I was getting into all the, you know, the sequels, The Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, you name it. I was watching them, and I just fell in love with horror way back then. And my dream was to write a horror novel, and I started and stopped more times than I can count because I just couldn't figure out the formula of how to get through a full-length novel. So I started when I was an undergrad, I started writing stage plays, and some of those were like murder mysteries, and others were sort of horror in nature, and others were like dark comedy. So I tried to branch out and do things in that realm, and then I stopped doing that, and eventually I decided, you know, I want to just write down some ideas and come up with some ideas. And every time I would come up with an idea, it seemed to fall flat. Okay, and I'm pretty much my worst critic when I write, so if I can't come up with something that I think is going to be good, I'm probably going to give up on it, or at least file it away for later. And the worst part of my writing is my endings. It's like, okay, I can come up with what I think is a good idea, but where am I going with the story here? Is it going to come up with an ending? And with the book that's coming out, which is, I got a pretty cool story on that one, I actually was able to outline where I wanted to go with it, what I wanted to do with it, and how I wanted it to end, which is kind of really have discovered was really helpful when you're trying to write something, because you actually have an idea of where you're going with it.
You know what we forgot? We forgot to introduce the fact that I actually have a guest co-host. I got so wrapped up in these tales of woe for Catholic churches and Catholic schools that I forgot all about. We have Christopher Pugh with us tonight.
Everyone forgets me. Don't you worry about that.
Now, he has sat in on the show, but he's never been on a mic on the show yet. So this is his first co-hosting duty. And, of course, we would have to dive right into clergy molestation humor within the first, like...
I mean, if I'm here, I guess that's where we're going to go. So
now, this is something that obviously perplexes a lot of the... and this is not sexist at all, but perplexes a lot of our female... interviewees that we have, is that as soon as they come on, we ask their age. It's like we go right straight for the jugular, and we're like, when you're born. So how old are you, Eric?
44.
Okay, I'm 43. So this whole idea of, first of all, if you didn't have this fantastic sensation of experiencing 80s horror in the 80s, like, we feel for you, because if you're a horror fan now, or just a genre fan, sci-fi, horror, whatever, the 80s was a fantastic time, fantastic
Wonderful.
Time. There were ideas first of all, I digress. So what we didn't have is, especially during the earlier part of the 80s, is we didn't have this emphasis of direct-to-video yet.
Right.
Like, a lot of movies, a lot of small movies got theatrical runs, albeit they might have been in only a smattering of theaters, but they still had theatrical runs. See, first of all, you had all the movies that were still shot on film, because they basically were shooting on film because they were shooting for theaters. They were they were shooting on film.
Right.
Then, of course, we get video, and then it changes absolutely everything. But for those of us who were around in the 80s, we got to see some really small, like, art house horror stuff.
Right,
and then we also got to see some small horror stuff that exploded just because it had that first run in actual theaters.
Right,
and I think that theater experience helped a lot of these films. I mean, Friday the 13th was a small film.
Yep.
This is a small film. By today's standards, it would be extremely difficult for a film like Friday the 13th to gain the kind of momentum and fandom that franchise has.
Yeah, no doubt.
But it just sort of exploded because we had had films that had pieces of that slasher code to it. It was like we saw films that were almost slasher films. They had those elements, but we didn't really know what a slasher film was yet. And strangely enough, you know, Friday the 13th is really the perfect storm. It really
right.
is. It took all of these elements that a lot of horror directors were trying out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to try out this sort of iconic singular killer. You know, we want to try out this idea of making a film that basically hints at an urban legend, but we're making an urban legend while we're making the film. It had a meta quality to it, you know? It has this idea of there's history. Like, there's a mythology to it. So a lot of these movies had bits and pieces of what Friday the 13th really had to offer. And by no means is Friday the 13th the first film a perfect film.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's got some god-awful acting in it. I mean, most of the shots, for the most part, it's like, let's just have a wide medium shot.
Right.
That'll
do
it. Yeah. Nothing fancy.
We'll be fine. Just go.
You know? It's like, I know Steve Meyer and those guys didn't have, like, pencil-thin mustaches and berets on. For some reason, I just had this image of a guy with a really thin, long cigarette going, nothing fancy, guys. You know, like an old carnival barker or like a vaudevillian comedian. Nothing fancy, guys. Keep it simple. Keep it rolling. Keep it simple. But, you know, in that, they managed, first of all, to do this very non-complicated, but yet very sort of rich and colorful film that took all these this variety of elements from different films. Mm-hmm. And it's like they just, it was a blueprint for a perfect horror film. Even though it wasn't a perfect film, it was the blueprint for this is what a horror film was.
Right.
I mean, before then, when we look back, and I mean, I love old horror films too. I love old Lugosi films, and I love stuff like White Zombie and
Classics.
And The Bat and stuff like that. Like, I love stuff like that, but for the most part, they had no idea where they were going. And you can see that an awful lot.
Oh, yeah.
And it was also usually, it's like, we've got a sinister presence, and then we've got someone who's traveling with their lady friend, and now she is the target of the sinister presence.
Of course.
And everyone has to band together to save her. It's like, that's sort of what these movies were about. I mean, even you look at the old stuff, even and especially when we started to get into the late 40s and 50s, that was really the formula. You know, it's like, we get a bunch of guys, and then we get the one female role, and then she's the target of whatever insidious evil it is, and then they've sort of got a band together to save her.
Well, yeah, that too, and you didn't have the saturated market that you have now. So you had these films that were able to get out there, where you have, you know, dozens of these small little market films that get out there. They're just as good, if not better, but no one knows about them, especially because of the on-demand, all the streaming services, you know, the straight-to-video movies anymore. Take all that away. You take away the ability to be able to really band together around a certain series, a certain small genre inside of, you know, the horror movie, you know, complex out there, and it's just... It's kind of like, you know, we now have all these options, which are great for modern era, but it doesn't allow for any of these, you know, younger guys that are really trying to break in there to really get a name for themselves.
You know, in a lot of the more villainous characters, the horror villains that we had, usually fell into two categories. One was you know, guy in a suit, it's a monster. and the monster was usually just, in hindsight, God, they were horny.
Oh, yeah.
It was
just
a bunch of horny monsters. Yeah. It was because obviously we were living vicariously through these creatures.
That's right.
You know,
it
was just like, oh, she's so pretty. Why don't you just go in there and grab her? Because I can't. It's not civil.
Right.
But, you know, in the director's minds, it was like, he comes in and he grabs her. He grabs her. And that's like, that's an hour and like 18 minutes as the creature comes in. He grabs her. She's screaming and kicking her legs, and then they got to find her. Or the other sort of villainous character was the puppet master character. So he was always getting people to do his bidding, and usually they were in some kind of trance or fugue-like state, and then they grabbed her, but it wasn't him grabbing her. It was just he had other people grab her.
Yeah.
And so it was always like, well, all we got to do is either kill the monster or we find the guy controlling the monster. That was the big thing. Like, that was the MacGuffin for the longest time, was like, we just got to find the monster, the guy controlling the monster. And that's essentially how we rid ourselves of the problem. You know, we were easily able to get these problems solved within about an hour and 18 minutes, you know, for the most part. And then the sequels were all just, you know, wash, rinse, and repeat. Now, we get into the 70s, and all of a sudden, the 70s are much more complex. The 70s, for starters, like, we had TV movies. You know, the 60s didn't have nearly as many horror TV movies. The 70s exploded with horror on TV. You know, and we had episodic horror on TV.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we started to have stuff like Dark Shadows. And even then, now we had, you know, because to tell you the truth, there were some riskier episodes of The Night Gallery. you know? And then we had Kolchak. Like, we had these real episodic horror stuff that we didn't have in the 60s. So the 70s into the early 80s had that. So, and then we had, you know, the 80s all of a sudden had the unstoppable villain. You know, and that was something that we hadn't really seen before. You know, even in like you know, The Thing from Another World, obviously, which is one of my favorites.
Right.
You know, it's like we still knew he wasn't unstoppable. You know, he was sort of unstoppable, but he was unstoppable because, you know, his qualities were preternatural. We just needed to find out what they were. And then, you know, once we found that out, we could stop them. Mm-hmm. And then we started to get real iconic villains. We started to get these characters that sort of existed out of time and space. Like, there was really no way you were going to stop these things. And the idea, too, that it didn't matter how fast you ran, it didn't matter what you did, they were right behind you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's always interesting for me, even though Chris is a little bit younger than us, but it's interesting for me, especially because I feel like I was like 43, 44, 45 is like horror age. Like really, we are those guys who were there for some of the beginning stuff, and then we were there for really for the icons and then the stereotypes to really, you know, show themselves and become more iconoclastic. And then, you know, the new stuff. Like, we have more of this journey than some of the newer fans do. So having that knowledge, when you went into writing the book, did any of that knowledge influence what you wanted to do and how you wanted to do it?
Not too much. I mean, I again, growing up, of course, in the 80s, and you with the slashers, I was always sort of drawn to the series, you know, the Friday the 13th and the Nightmare on Elm Street, even the old Sleepaway Camps, you know, the really bad horror movies.
Yeah.
But they're so bad you just love to watch them.
When the villain was a dick.
Yes.
Literally.
Exactly.
Like, the great evil was a penis.
Oh my gosh. That was hilarious.
But wasn't that a fantastic reveal, though, at the end?
It was. It was an unexpected ending. I mean, that's what makes a good movie in general.
The mouth wide open, the huge disco bush, and then the penis.
Yes. I mean, that just, if you had not seen it, you had not heard about it, if you were watching it for the first time and you saw that, I mean, your mouth is wide open like, okay.
And when you go back and watch it today, you don't realize how fucking goofy the rest of the movie is.
Oh, God,
yes. It's horrible.
The rest of the movie is so bad.
It is.
But it's like, that end was such a pants shitter.
The last 10 minutes of the movie, it was just like, what in the heck is going on?
It was like, you forget about the cook, you forget about everything
else
in that movie, and you remember her. That's what you remember.
Right. Yep.
So you like the episodic stuff, you like the series and the franchises.
Yeah, I mean, and when it came to writing the book, it's just more about trying to find something that is scary, something that hasn't been done to death. That's really been kind of my thing, is trying to find something unique. So, like I said before, when I've been trying to write these stories, a lot of them just didn't have a whole lot of meat on the bones. There really wasn't much. I didn't know where it was going. So to be able to find where I was going with this one was, I mean, and I spit out the first draft in maybe 6 months. So, and then after I did my first edit, I added maybe another 20,000 words to it because I was able to expand on the story. I mean, that's probably the best piece of advice I've ever got when you're writing is don't edit when you're writing. Don't think too much. Just put the crap out there, write it, and once you're done, then you can go back and fix whatever needs to be fixed. But you got to get the story out there first. So my biggest issue was trying to get scary.
I
want
to believe that is the singular reason behind the success of Nickelback.
Yeah.
just produce.
That's the only thing that they've got.
Just
keep going. Just keep going.
Just keep producing music. And we'll never break up. Just keep producing music.
You're bound to get something on the top charts. That's all it is.
They found the rock and roll formula. Keep producing and don't break up.
Right, exactly.
So obviously, and we don't want to quit your work to Nickelback. Like, we don't want to do that right out of the starting gate.
Oh, wow.
But those are great words of wisdom, though. It's like, you know, just produce.
Right. Because you can always go back and change things. But you just got to get the idea out there while you're thinking about it. And for me, it was just, I had to go by an outline. And until I outlined everything out, I didn't really want to write a whole lot down. If I had like a quotation of something I wanted to say, well, I'll type that out and I'll come back to it later. But for the most part, I said, this is how many parts I want it to, this is how many parts I want it to be. This is kind of what I want each chapter to kind of encompass. And then, of course, you can always change things as you're moving along, but you at least have a goal from where you're starting and then when you're going to finally finish. This is where I want it to finally go. If that changes along the way and it's better, then great. But at least that gives you kind of the momentum to be writing this. And to me, coming up with an idea that I think would kind of be scary to think about is that was the key for me to writing something in the horror genre.
So when it came to that, and you're going back to your edits too after you already came that, like, how did you try and come about adding that many extra words through your edits to kind of finalize your vision there?
Well, part of it was I was coming up with questions on my own. I was reading this and saying, well, how did this character get to this point? And then what happens to this character? And there were a couple of things that I felt that I'd left out and that had more, there was more story to be told on a couple of the characters. And I think it sort of blended the story together a lot better than the first draft had. Really was what it was mostly about. Because when you have, you know, once you're done and you're ready for your beta readers to look it over, my biggest question would be, find any inconsistencies. Tell me, is this character make any sense? Am I forgetting something? Did I start a little subplot that just died and didn't go anywhere? I want to know a lot of these things. So when I first, you know, my first draft was done and I started reading it through and editing, I'm like, okay, this is good, but there's more to this than what I'm writing about. I'm kind of jumping ahead a little too much here. I think there's some more side scenes here that I can work on and make this even stronger.
So, since it comes out the first, mm-hmm. there's probably not a huge chance of somebody stealing your idea. However,
I would hope not.
Since this is being recorded for posterity, and it will be released probably within the next 48 hours, we do know that, as far as digital rights management goes, that you're in the clear. You can actually use this audio if you needed to go to court.
Cool.
So, can you give us a synopsis?
Sure.
I mean, we don't know if this is like a twisty turny kind of story, so we don't know what you could or could not give
mm-hmm,
away.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as what you can tell us in a synopsis about what the book is about.
Sure. Well, I'll actually, the short version of this, the whole idea was inspired by a piece of jewelry, okay? I'll give you a little backstory. I have a friend, one of my best friends from high school. She's an artist. She does a lot of...
See, I wondered why the book was called Prince Albert in a Can.
Yep. I came up with the idea in the can. Oh no. Actually, I might have, to be quite honest with you.
Hey, that's where the best ideas come.
Exactly. But no, she creates these pieces of jewelry, like the necklaces, earrings, little trinkets out of computer parts, like machine parts, like old motherboards and wires
that's
and things
awesome.
Like that. And she just creates these, and they're so cool. And she had one that just caught my eye, and I'm going to show you a picture of it here in a little bit. But it was of a tree, and it was like it had a round top to it, and it was just so cool looking. And I just thought it was
just gorgeous.
Yeah,
that's beautiful.
You could tell she kind of used maybe the kind of the inside of the computer or the RAM.
Use a little bit of the chip.
Now, can we post the picture with the audio?
If you'd like to,
okay,
sure.
Okay, just so
sure.
that people can see what we're looking at. I think
yeah,
that'd be great.
But I saw that, and it's just really cool. She's very talented in this, and she's actually also became my illustrator too, because I had some pictures to it. But and I just started thinking, that's really cool. But you know, a tree with a round top. Where have I seen that before? And I was probably bored or something, so I looked it up. Turns out the tree's name is a dragon's blood tree. And it's only seen in Yemen or something like that. And so I'm like, well, Dragon's Blood, man, that's a cool title. And I've been working on another story that I thought, well, maybe this could be a horror novel, and it wasn't going anywhere. And I thought, Dragon's Blood, that is a cool title. Where can I go with this? And I'm thinking, well, somebody's probably used the title before. So I'm researching and thinking, maybe there's a movie or a book. There are no mainstream movies. There's maybe a couple of old independent books that have used a similar title or something, but no one's really, it's not something that's out there. It's not The Shining or something, you know, nothing that's...
Nothing's going to be big and crazy.
Right, exactly. So I thought, well, Dragon's Blood, what can I, you know, and that's, well, it's got to involve a tree, a dragon, and a lot of blood. So I made sure to include all of that. So, I mean, really the story is kind of like two intertwined stories. There's the present day where we've got these weird things going on off in this wooded area out, you know, off of this really old park. So the setting is a fictitious city called Northdale, right outside, like a suburb of New York. So I use New York City a lot in the book. So,
or what kind of like setting year wise are we looking at here, so we can kind of get more of a feel of exactly? Because I mean, New York, of course, you know, we're looking at many different things outside of the years.
Well, most of the book is present day.
Okay.
But the other story is there's a lot of chapters that discuss this journal from a 100-year-old resident named Betty, and she's talking about things that happened to her back in 1930, in which she describes herself as this kind of a weird kid that loved reptiles, and she had friends who were, they called themselves the Reptile Gang, and they would go around looking for snakes and lizards and things like that. And one day at the park, she and a friend found this kind of weird looking reptilian thing. They didn't know what it was. It had a big head. Its arms were almost like sharp talons, and she just thought it was the, you know, cute thing. So she sneaks it home as a pet. Come to find out, it's got some very violent tendencies. It cuts her on the side of her neck, and she decides, okay, we got to get rid of this thing. So she and her friends take it back out to the woods and release it, and she thinks she's done with it. Next thing you know, she's having these really horrible dreams where she's following this creature as it's killing people in the woods. And when she, you know, wakes up, she thinks it's just a dream until she sees the newspaper and there's the big picture. You know how the old headlines of the old days would have the big words and the big picture.
Yeah.
And there's that says mutilated body found in park. And it's the picture is the person that she saw killed in her dream. So she's convinced it's the creature that they release. So they go out there to try to kill it. When they're able to, she buries it in the woods. But it turns out that it may be stopped, but it's not dead. And she's chronicling all these things that happened to her up until, like I said, she's 100 years old. She feels this thing is keeping her alive for a reason. But it's trying to escape. It's kind of a wooded... what do you want to call it? It's kind of wooded prison. It's kind of a trapped in the woods somewhere. So the tagline of the book is "Don't go down the trail." So
Don't go down the trail.
Nope. Back in 1930s, there was this walking trail in the woods there that people would take when they go to the park. Present day though, it's kind of been, you know, grass has grown all around it. People can't find it anymore. So that's her story. But then to the present day story centers more around a retired FBI agent he got a phone call from a state senator who he saved his life a few years ago. The senator says his wife went missing. He doesn't want to get the press or anybody involved yet. He needs his friend to help him kind of find out what happened. So we're kind of following this guy while he's trying to figure out what's going on, trying to find out what happened to the wife, who actually by this point we already know what happened to her because it happens a chapter earlier, without giving too much away. But then, of course, these two sort of connect by about the middle part of the book, and the rest of the book is about trying to figure out what this creature has become, what's going to happen, what it's trying to do, and is it going to escape, and what's going to happen if it escapes. So
now, this had this been something that you had been thinking about for a long time? Had this been something where the idea had been floating around and then you finally got it out, or was this a relatively new idea for you?
This is a relatively new idea, actually.
Well, and I like the idea of these things and the sort of like the symbiotic relationships, because we saw, strangely enough, we used to see a lot of that in what would you consider real ghost stories.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, you know, entities would attach themselves to some kind of a host.
Mm-hmm.
And strangely enough, because you said, look, this is so bizarre, I don't know why this would pop up in my head, but when you were talking about like a little creature and the fact that the little creature and this woman is somehow joined, I always end up thinking about the story about this weird talking weasel. Has anyone ever heard this?
I've not heard that one.
No, I have not.
Okay, and I can't remember exactly where it happened, but if you get an opportunity, you know, go to the interwebs and take a look for real talking weasel. So this was a story that actually circulated among the press for a long time, is that there was a farm that someone apparently had a weasel that was actually talking. and it was talking almost in like an Edgar Casey sense. It was telling bizarre stories. It had these mood swings. It's one of the most bizarre sort of like...
I mean, if I was a talking weasel, I'd probably have mood swings
like,
too.
Right. It's like quasi-cryptozoological kind of thing going on. But when you're talking about like, you know, her finding this thing, you know, and this thing is like something she hadn't... There are stories that sort of mirror that. In like the 20s and 30s, or even like the 1890s to the 30s, there was a lot of that spiritual movement and a lot of really strange stories circulated. So my interest has peaked already because obviously I have a preoccupation with talking weasels. So and even though it's a very tenuous thread, the fact that I was able to connect it, that to me is very, very interesting.
Cool.
I also love this idea that... And I don't really have to talk about evil. We can talk about something more just sort of strange. Mm-hmm. That strangeness, sort of when it hits us, permeates us throughout our entire life. I mean, something sort of strange happens to you. Right. It really does affect your worldview.
Oh, yeah. And you always remember it. You always try and recall it, and you always think back to it.
Yeah.
Something to kind of hold on to.
It has this own sort of legacy and this own, you know, lineage, like your kids carry on the story, and it sort of becomes part of their life as well, you know, and part of their narrative. Mm-hmm. And so that's very interesting to me. Yeah. Now, has this been your first attempt at writing a full horror novel?
Yeah, it has. I've got some more ideas coming up. I'm working on a new one now. I'm at about 30,000 words, and that's one that I actually had started years ago as a stage play, and it didn't really turn out that way. And I went back to it, and I thought, well, this could actually work as a novel. And so I'm kind of working on that now as well. But this idea just kind of came to me when I first saw that little necklace, and it just kind of the idea just kind of came to me at that point. I got the kind of like Friday the 13th. They had the title of a movie. They took out a big old New York Times ad and didn't even have a plot or anything.
Yep.
So yeah, I had the title before I even had the story. So I was going off of that. But then again. Tree, blood, and dragons. How can I use all of that? So it just kind of came to me, really.
See, this is also one of those times, too, where when we do the live show, I almost wish we were doing this live tonight because we found the perfect light switch cover based on
I don't know if we're going to call this a perfect light switch cover. I mean, I've been sitting here having to stare at a screen that's a sleepaway camp light switch cover, and I'm going to let everyone think about that for a second, especially after we're talking about the end of the movie there. What I've had to sit here and stare at for the last about 15 minutes.
It's vivid.
Minutes.
Yeah, but shouldn't the light switch part be a little lower?
I would much appreciate if the light switch cover...
There is a missed opportunity here.
Yeah.
I will say there is a missed opportunity here, most certainly. Like, they really could have done wonders, and now I'm looking, is there a different light switch cover?
I mean, not that how I'm many sleepaway camp light switch covers do there need to be on the market right now?
Well, obviously the quintessential one is a slightly remodeled version of the one that we're seeing here. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, I'm also thinking maybe that's why she was so angry.
That could be
There's not a lot going on there, but
it was cold out.
But there
is
disco bush too. We do say that there's disco bush.
She was in the water.
It was the summer.
Yeah,
maybe she was swimming before that.
It could have been. And like I said, disco bush. You know, it's like there might be a whole lot going on.
So if you're gonna move that, are you gonna add actual hair to the light switch cover itself?
You see, this is like an Etsy shop's dream come true, this conversation that we're having right now. All I ask is that someone send me a free one so that I can laugh and then have nightmares about it for the rest of my life.
Yep. Every time you turn on and off the light switch. Yep.
Now, interestingly enough, and this is something that I don't think a lot of people could have predicted, but when we saw, and people always talk about this death of print, you know, which we haven't really seen. You know, print is still there. Obviously, it's dwindled. You know, we see lowered numbers. But strangely enough, I think we're seeing this reinvention, especially of horror literature, with the internet that we didn't expect. I mean, the amount of horror authors that now have the accessibility and the low overhead to put their stuff online is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that interesting because we sort of thought it was like, you know, this is the downhill slope. And we have something like, for example, we have something like Creepypasta. I mean, which is just a literal dumping ground for stories upon stories upon stories. You know, albeit of varying quality, but you do have a lot of burgeoning young writers there that are very good.
Yeah, I mean, I have connected with a number of writers all over the world, really, and there's so many writers of so many genres, but there are a lot of people who want to write horror, which I think is awesome. My favorite author, of course, Stephen King, but you've got your Dean Koontz's, you got your mainstream authors, but it's great to see independent authors trying to get their stuff out there and having the balls to try to do it, because now there is an easier way than trying to go traditional publishing, because you can self-publish now. You do have a lot of ways that you can do that and to get your stuff out there. Some people don't want to sit around for 10 years to wait for a rejection letter from a publishing company.
Right.
It's like, you know what, I want to publish this. I know I'm not going to make, $1 million off of it, but I like the story. I want to write it. I want to get it published, and I don't want to wait around for, someone who's not even going to read it to reject it. So, I mean, there's a lot of options out there. Now, I'm not saying that is always good, because I'm sure there's a lot of crap out there that people aren't, really taking the time. And I learned from, after I wrote my first book, I learned from the mistakes I made with that one to get an editor, to not just run out there and publish it, to make sure it's formatted correctly, to do all the back, behind the scenes things that are needed to make sure it looks professional, that it looks good, that it sounds good. That I've probably done 24 edits to this thing, and I finally had to say, enough's enough, stop editing, stop changing one word here and there, because you're never going to be done with it. Story's
you get to a point you need to have it out,
right? Exactly. But I mean, the first time out, I think I rushed it a little bit, and it's better now. I've published several different editions of it now, that's a lot better. But I have actually seen some people that have published like through Amazon or some of those other sites, and you just read it and you're like, okay, I'm not an editor, but I can edit things. I've got an English and communication degrees, and I can, I'm good at that kind of stuff. And I look at some of these and I'm like, oh yeah, I get what you're saying here, but you could have taken away some of the adverbs, and your one paragraph has this same word 10 times, which again, I'm guilty of doing that kind of thing too. That's why I stress getting an editor, and I was fortunate enough that I know a lady who was an editor for a magazine that I wrote for, and she volunteered to edit for me. And I thought that was wonderful, because I really needed another set of eyeballs on this to make sure that I'm not missing something. That because I can edit somebody else's writing, but when it comes to my own, I will miss some of the most obvious crap that I should have caught when I was first writing it.
Oh yeah, when you're sitting there looking at your own stuff, whether you realize it or not, you're starting to skim, because you know what's coming next.
Exactly.
You know what's going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's this double-edged sword with being a horror author, which, first of all, you're sort of able to have more of a stream of consciousness writing style than a lot of other genres.
Right.
Almost, as if you're sort of writing prose. I mean, you look at a lot of horror authors, and there's a lot of interesting alliteration of things that a lot of horror authors do.
Right.
Like, because
I
think, for the most part, those shackles, the shackles that a lot of authors have are sort of pulled off when you start to enter the world of horror, especially because we're looking for something so visceral from a lot of these authors.
Oh, yeah.
But unfortunately, and we're talking about the other edge, is that you're also hitting a lot of hardcore horror fans. So you might get a person who says, hey, this is great. I'm entering the world of being a horror author. I've got this great idea. But there are so many ideas in the world of horror that have already been done.
Yep,
it's almost like you've got to become a mini historian. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got to take a look at what is already out there. And it's so vast that unfortunately, I think, and it's also the burden on a lot of, early horror filmmakers, too, because they're like, I want to make a horror film. Well, if you're already a fan of horror, I will say it's worlds easier, because you've sort of got this history that you can look at.
Yep.
You don't really have to do tons of research.
Yeah, you have an understanding.
Yeah,
exactly. Getting into horror is sort of, I guess sort of being deflowered is, a pretty brutal experience, because, a lot of horror fans are near encyclopedic in their knowledge of horror.
Right,
so,
right.
My wife always jokes with me. She's like, how in the world do you know this? And I'm like, but look at all the shit that I don't know. Which then she'll be like, of course, there's plenty. But
exactly.
But we do have a special strangely enough, I think, and this also goes for a lot of sci-fi fans too, and I think people who are fans of literature who reread and fans of film who rewatch, is that there is a particular component of the fan's brain, the fanatic's
mm-hmm.
brain,
right. mm-hmm.
that is able to, again, have that almost encyclopedic memory for something very finite.
Oh yeah.
You know, and because of that, unfortunately, you know, it's really easy to judge the person that comes along and does something that might be done in a different way, but still sort of rings uh-huh. a familiarity.
Right. I always say if I could memorize scientific formulas the way I memorize quotes from 80s horror movies, man, I would be in a so much better place.
Oh, yeah.
I'd have like 4 doctorates by now.
I mean,
I can quote so many of those movies, and it's like, how do you know that? I don't know. I've seen the movie 700 times.
I'll be sitting there, and I'll be like, you know, that's interesting because I didn't realize that Greg Cannon did the special effects for that. And he also did the special effects for the Werewolf television show, which is one of Fox's first run shows. And my wife was like, why? Why?
You know, I think yeah, the yeah, same yeah. thing. You know, I felt that I was a horror movie fanatic for years. I thought that I was a horror movie fanatic. And then I ran into people like you, and I'm like, apparently I know nothing about
right,
horror movies.
Exactly.
I'm apparently this beginner that's never seen anything out there. I don't know what's going on.
we're going to go on the Wayback Machine. We're going to go on the Wayback. So we're going to do a mini genesis of me,
okay.
and then we'll get back uh-huh. to Eric, uh-huh. is that I grew up in a town of about 500 people, okay? And I did not have a neighboring town for like another 9 miles. So we were literally just this island, this small rural island in Illinois. And the only thing that I had was horror films. Like that was, as a kid, like that was pretty much my primary interest. Like before, I would say when I was young, like we're talking first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, sort of in that area, I was hugely into sports, but I was hugely into non-competitive sports to have a good time. So I was always playing, you know, like Little League, you know, T-ball. I was on, you know, like different Pee-wee leagues for different sports. And then all of a sudden, it started to become competitive, and I just started hating it. Like, I couldn't get into it. I didn't understand why we weren't having fun any longer.
Right.
I didn't understand why all the coaches were angry all the time
and never
bought us ice cream. And why they all became...
why does everyone else get this like, and I don't?
Well, we're going to Custard Castle after the game,
like,
guys.
Cranky bastards.
So are you responsible for the participation trophies? Is that what we're saying right here?
Oh, like, what I was yeah, exactly. And, like, I was actually halfway decent. I didn't understand why this one kid who I thought was on par with me, you know, was able to play more than I was. And then all of a sudden you realize, holy shit, there's like politics here. You know, why is there politics in kids' sports? And it became very unfun for me.
Oh, yeah.
So the only thing that I had really besides sports at that point was I really loved movies. So if I wasn't out playing something, I was then, you know, watching movies as much as I could. And my mother was a huge fan. So we would wait for the midnight movies. You know, we stayed and watched these midnight movies. And I've talked about this before in the air, so I'll just sort of skim over this part. But what ended up happening is that in a town of 500 people, and I had 2 preoccupations and one was eliminated, I threw everything I had into the other one. So, you know, I would beg my parents to end up, you know, driving me an hour to where I knew there'd be Fangoria magazines.
Oh,
that, yeah.
You gotta take me because I know there's an issue out that I don't have. Or Famous Monsters of Filmland. I would go through used bookstores looking for old copies mm-hmm. of Famous Monsters of Filmland. And then there would be stuff in that, you know, that was like the gateway drug, by the way. Because then I'd be like, what's eerie? What is this thing? And it looks a little adult. And it's like, and Vampirella, why do my pants not fit all of a sudden? This is weird. And then I would like look for all these Vampirella magazines, you know, which were magazines, you know, like they were actual magazines.
Well, I had the one this
they were
weekend.
Warren magazines. Eerie, I think, was part of the Warren family too back then.
I had the one this weekend that was who's Elvira, is what does she do? Okay let's go ahead and give a history real quick.
it was this weird thing that like I threw everything I had into it, and it was these breadcrumbs, you know, because I had nobody else in this town who really cared,
yeah,
you know, and, mm-hmm, and, yeah. and furthermore who really cared that I cared,
yeah,
like no one even cared that I was interested. They were just like, why in the world are you even, like, you know, telling me about the stuff that I don't have an interest in, and then therefore you're so specific about it that I already hate it.
It's already gone.
There's already research I have to do. This feels like work. Like, I should not talk to a 9-year-old and feel like I have to go work to figure out what the hell he's talking about. So that was a big thing. And strangely enough, like, I remember the... And it's weird talking about it now because, and especially talking about it if people don't understand pre-internet, like, research. Like, pre-internet research was literally, it was like, God, does anybody watch The Curse of Oak Island? Does anybody know what it is?
I have not. It is on my queue. I have yet to get into it yet. It's just too much out
there. It's like that's what pre-internet research was like, okay? You're digging for treasure, and all of a sudden seawater comes up, and you're like, where the fuck is the seawater coming from? It's because you don't have that access to all these points of information.
Right.
So I would get, you know, an Old Famous Monsters, a Filmland magazine, and I was like, what's 13 ghosts? What the fuck is this?
Yeah.
I don't know what this is. What the fuck is this? So then, and I'd be like, William Castle? Who the hell is this guy? So it was like all these breadcrumbs, and I would end up going to the library to find a book on movies because I would find that this guy was referenced in the back of the book.
Yeah.
So it was part of the reference material for this book, this compendium of horror films.
Before the internet age was a fun time.
Right, the big old thick book of movie titles, and you'd see one and you'd reference another one. Oh, so cool. And
I might even still have one of those sitting at home, the encyclopedias of movies still.
I waited, and I shit you not, 46 weeks in the Lincoln Trail Library System.
Oh, gosh.
For Stephen King's The Gunslinger.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And that was before the series became popular again. So that was before we had paperback versions of The Wasteland, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, there's a Stephen King book I have not read. The library doesn't have it. And it's called The Dark Tower, The Gunslinger. What the fuck is this? And I think my 9-year-old self even said that to the librarian.
Oh.
I remember saying something that both shocked and disgusted her about the inability of the Lincoln Trail Library System here in Illinois to get the book.
It wasn't about asking for a Stephen King book at the age of 9.
That might have been part of it, yes.
Yeah, and also going in there and going, I'm personally jaded with the politics of local sports. Bring me my Stephen King novel, and bring it to me now. And, like, I just remember coming in, like, once a week and being like, hey, bitch, where's the gunslinger? And it was like, this woman.
So now I understand why she had this, like, disgust towards you.
She had to have hated me.
Oh, yeah. She was probably holding the book back at that point.
She had it. She got it, like, 3 weeks after you ordered it.
She had five copies
of it.
She just had them hidden under there. She'd look down at the book and be like, they're not here.
I noticed that every person that died, their name was crossed out and my name was put in the book. And I'm like, this is a weird coincidence. But it was like every week, as soon as I come in, she'd just start shaking her head. And I'm like, you don't know what I'm going to ask for, do ya?
She knows exactly what you're going to ask for.
Am I going to ask for the gunslinger? Maybe not. Maybe I'm going to ask for something else.
You're not asking for anything else.
No, I was asking for the same goddamn book time and time and time again. So, and by the way, I now, strangely enough, because of that breadcrumb, I'm a huge Dark Tower fan.
Oh, yeah. Love it.
I even have memorabilia from that shitty movie just because it's got the Dark Tower.
Yeah.
It's like, but the good thing that, I will say this, the good thing that came out about the film was the fact that we actually started to get memorabilia. That was one good thing that happened, was that I got a couple of, for example, I actually have a shirt that says All Hail the Crimson King.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
I would never have got that. Cool. You know, and plus, it's referenced in a way that it doesn't directly reference the movie.
Right.
Like, I can still be like semi-cool. It's like, just don't look at the tag. I'll just tear the tag off.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thing, and I think especially for people who write, because it's breadcrumbs. You know, we're looking for breadcrumbs.
Right.
And when you find that breadcrumb and it leads to the next thing and the next thing and next thing, it's this elation. You know, it really is. As a creator, it's elation. It's like, this is coming together and I can't believe it's coming together. I can't believe it's mine and it's coming together, you know, which is an weirder but greater feeling.
It is.
So I'm going to go ahead and give you a free idea here. especially for another local individual, an artist, go ahead and try and make some collector's editions. They're signed books that actually have other little trees that are made there as like necklaces, pendants that you can go ahead and sell with those books.
Yeah.
Free idea. There
Thank
you go.
Thank you. All right.
And I will say, I will feel no ill will if in future books there is a character who is a 9-year-old asshole. Just a complete and total 9-year-old asshole.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because in hindsight,
all you have to say
is
9-year-old. Like, asshole's just implied when you say 9-year-old. That's just how it is.
I was
the smugness.
Yes.
The smugness.
I was horrible. Absolutely horrible.
Well, at 9, you're right in that in-between stage, right? Where the smugness comes out without meaning to, just because 9-year-olds just believe they're correct. They're always right.
Yeah, exactly.
So when she didn't have the book, you knew that you were right going in there. No, it's fully understandable. You don't even have to say asshole.
Oh, and I was totally
just
suspicious.
9-year-old is good.
And it's her fault you didn't have the book.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally her fault.
I was practically paranoid by the time this thing came in, because I do think she was probably holding it back from me. I
would agree.
I think by a certain point she might have been.
I don't even have to guess at that. I would almost put money on the fact that she had it underneath the counter and just was telling you to screw off. That's just how it was.
You know, if you're listening, and I don't know what your name is or what it was, or even if you're still alive, I know who you are. Actually, I don't. I just said it. I don't know who you are. Okay, you're free. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about a damn thing. Live in bliss.
If you didn't notice, he does still hold a grudge.
Yeah.
So be
Sounds
careful.
Like, yeah.
Watch where you're going.
I hold absolutely no grudge at all against that horrible, horrible person. Nothing at all. But obviously, my keen detection skills means that I have not researched her at all. So by chance, she is still alive and you're listening.
So go on vacation.
You're looking at a
librarian from 30 years ago. She's probably dead. I'm not trying to be mean. I'm just being realistic.
Although
at this
my first book teacher is still alive somehow, probably. So the book is coming out October 1st.
Correct.
Now, October obviously is a big month here. It's a big month, especially for people who are into horror and people who are horror creatives. Mm-hmm. Let's also talk about what else you've got going on. Let's talk about the Ghost Walk as well. So we mentioned it earlier in the hour. So give us the name again, because now it seems like that was eons ago.
Yeah. The Lincoln Ghost Walk is what it's called.
And it's here. Does it entirely take place in Springfield?
Yes, the whole thing is in Springfield. We start out at the old Capitol Plaza, and I tell some stories there for a little bit. And I'll preface this by saying this is it's a ghost walk, not a ghost hunt. We don't use the equipment to search for ghosts. We just kind of tell stories. But because it's getting later, we don't start till 7:30 p.m. So in this time of year, it's actually almost dark out by that point. And once we get to the house, it's completely dark. So it's really kind of a cool aura out there.
So none of the ghost hunter type stuff going on here?
None of the ghost hunter type stuff. It's just more historical stories that have been kind of passed down from the people who were closest to Abraham Lincoln, but these are mostly sort of like ghostly stories. I mean, I think you mentioned spiritualism earlier. There was a big thing with spiritualism back in the Lincoln's time. I think it was a really big thing in the 1850s, 1860s.
Yeah.
And
then it became, I think, repopularized in like the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think like 1915 to probably 1935. Like we have these
2010 with, you know, the holistic.
We have these cycles.
right. But there was a big thing about back then, because like Mary Lincoln used to hold seances in the White House, and people think about that and go, wow, they let her do that.
A lot of people don't realize that either. Yeah.
And Lincoln was involved in some of that as well.
Yes, he was.
So it's, I mean, some of these stories that they hear them and they just kind of, they're taken aback, like, well, are these real stories? Like, well, you can believe them or not, but these are stories that have been passed down, you know, from the people who were closest to Lincoln. I mean, he always talked about dreams and visions that he had throughout his life that kind of predicted the future. And a number of people would talk about how he would always talk about these stories. He had a vision on the 91, the presidency, the night he was elected president. He had a vision in his room that night. And Mary was telling him, well, the vision means you're going to be elected twice, but you're not going to survive that second term. And just little things like that. And there's a story about a dream that he had, several dreams that he had before he died that sort of predicted his death. So these are just, and then, of course, we tell about the White House stories of Lincoln's ghost, which, of course, if you do any research, you'll find Lincoln's ghost in the White House. He's like the number one ghost seen in the White House, I guess. I guess they have a list of ghosts seen, but Lincoln is atop that list.
You can also look at the research, too, when you look at if people don't believe the whole thing about the seances or mm-hmm. the predicting the dreams and stuff like that. Right. It's actually very well documented. There's a lot that's out there that people can actually read up on to mm-hmm. actually look at some of this as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and for people who have not visited Illinois' capital, strangely enough, downtown, it's like a town within a town. I mean, there really yeah. is a sort of living history. Now, where does the walk go through that?
It doesn't really go through a ton of Springfield history. We talk a little bit about, at the beginning, about Lincoln's life here in Springfield, but also about his funeral, his final funeral, because mm-hmm. he had 12 funerals total.
And,
yeah, so we talk a little bit about that. And we also talk about the tomb site. And after Lincoln was left at the tomb site, all the things that happened to, you know, for the next 3.5 decades, that some really, really strange things that were happening out at the tomb site, you know, from all the times he was moved to all the times his coffin was opened and why, and people thinking they're seeing his ghosts out there, and the attempted theft of his coffin mm-hmm. in it was the late 1800s as well, until they finally had to pretty much bury him in concrete. So there's a lot of historical stories that were, and I've lived in Springfield my whole life, and I had heard a few of the stories about the White House, but I had not heard, until I started doing this tour, heard all of these other stories. And of course, the more I've done this, the more research I've done on the topic, and I'm finding some fascinating information about Lincoln and some of the weird things that happened, you know, not only when he was alive, but after he died.
You know, there's one thing, too, that I really wish that I had been able to actually see more of it as well. My mother actually used to work for one of those Treasure Hunters Roadshow type things. And one of the books that they actually bought was from a officer that actually had a journal entry that actually spoke about how the fact that when he's talking about Lincoln, things like that, half of the platoon had to actually go and look for Booth, and half of them had to actually start to prepare and file for Lincoln's funeral as well. And it's mm-hmm. one of those, like, I just wish that I would have been able to personally actually hold and look at, you know, these entries and stuff like that, you know, mm-hmm. but, you know, that gets to be the point, especially with those shows you know, when you have to resell to either museums, things of those natures when right. it comes down to that. But it was one of those, you know, especially for a local, you know, local individual here, being able to hold one of those journals from one of the officers from mm-hmm. one of the platoons that actually had to do all that back in
yeah,
the day.
Yeah.
Now, I've been on a couple of ghost walks. I actually was fortunate enough to do some in Rhode Island, which are fantastic because there's such old country there.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot out there too when it comes down to the ghost walks.
Yeah, and Salem. I used to spend a lot of my
a
lot of Halloweens in Salem.
Oh, there's a lot of Salem. Oh, yeah.
I was within relative driving distance from Boston in the Salem.
Oh, yeah.
Which was fantastic. And the ghost walks there, obviously, you know, are pretty much the epicenter of where a lot of the ghost walks started. So as far as when you're actually doing the ghost walks itself, has there been claims of anything seen while on the walk?
Yes. There's actually one of the stories we tell once we get to the house is a story that happened several years ago out at the park, in which people claim they heard a horse and carriage coming up the street behind them. But when they turn around, there's nothing there. And this is apparently a story that's been heard by the tour guides out there several times over the years.
That's pretty
cool.
So
it's an interesting thing. And I had somebody, and this is actually kind of weird, because I'll tell you a little story about, you know, Mary Lincoln. There's a belief that Mary Lincoln might haunt the Lincoln home.
Mm-hmm.
People say they've seen this ghostly 5-foot apparition there, which of course Mary Lincoln was like 5'2". So people have also said, well, sometimes at night when you walk by the house, you know, there's the door, and then you see on both sides there's like 4 panes of glass on each side. Every once in a while, people will claim that on the right side, if you're looking at the house, the bottom 2 panes of glass just go dark for a moment. Mm. And that, I guess it happened enough times that someone went up there and decided to measure how tall that was. Comes out at like right at 5 feet. So again, they're talking about, well, let's marry Lincoln again. Well, about a month ago on one of these tours, And I hadn't told that story yet, okay? I was just going into the story about how Mary Lincoln might haunt the White House. This woman who was sitting on the bench in the front row, her eyes got really big. She turned around, looked at her husband who was sitting in the row behind her. He just kind of nodded at her. And after that, she said, "I thought I saw Mary Lincoln standing in that doorway." And I said, "Which part?" And she pointed to the exact part where the stories were coming from. And I hadn't told the story yet. And I was like, "Oh, well, just so happens that there's another little story here about those little panes of glass." So I thought that was interesting that someone else had come across this story that I hadn't even told yet.
That's pretty awesome right there.
Yeah.
Especially being on one of these walks and actually seeing some of the stuff that you guys are trying to give the history about. That's a lot of fun.
Now, for those Fitbit wearers out there, how much ground does the walk actually cover?
It's several blocks. Trying to think, maybe 7-8 blocks, maybe, because we start at the old Capitol, we go down towards kind of the visitor center there by the Lincoln home. We talk about a couple of the churches that were there, because one of the churches is the Church of Lincoln, considered the Church of the Lincoln family. But then we go around the corner, sit on the benches for several stories, and we finish up right in front of the house. So, and then, of course, most people have to walk back, so you're making the trek back there as well. So it's a pretty decent hike. If you don't like to walk, I would not recommend it. There's places to sit down along the way. Once we swim, when we walk, we stop. Sometimes I'll tell stories while we're walking. I've kind of added a story at the end to anybody who walks back with me, because I used to be a theater actor, and we've done Our American Cousin, which is, of course, the play Lincoln was at when he was assassinated, and we did that twice at the Hoagland Center, once in 2009 for the bicentennial, then we did it again in 2015 for the anniversary, the 150th anniversary of the assassination. So I'm telling a story that we did an actual show on the actual night of the anniversary, and we did a dinner and a show, so it was kind of a twofer thing, and how the dinner went a little long, so we started the show a little later than we would have. Now, if you know the history of the story, the history of John Wilkes Booth, his plan was to assassinate Lincoln after a specific line was delivered. There would be one actor on stage, he'd deliver the line, it was supposed to be the funniest line, and then he was going to shoot Lincoln, and he follows through with that. Well, the way we did it was, he delivers the line, and there's an audible gunshot, and then the play just freezes. We had an actress come out and explain not only what happened that night, how Booth got away and all this, but then that Pally, of course, stopped the play, but we were going to continue on and do the full play, which of course we did. Come to find out, within the next few minutes, the audible of the gunshot that we had was only about less than two minutes from the actual time Lincoln was shot.
Matched
up almost perfectly, and we discovered this pretty quickly too. And we didn't, of course, that we couldn't have planned that, and we wouldn't have even been close if the dinner had gone as expected. So that was kind of an eerie thing that we kind of experienced that night.
Now, what dates does the walk run through?
It runs every Tuesday through Saturday night. It begins at 7:30, and it runs through October 31st is when we end. And then we'll start up again in March, kind of give or take, depending on how the weather goes.
Okay. And it's current, correct? It's actually going on right now.
It might be going on right now. It's after 9 o'clock now, so it's probably over with by now. But it runs anywhere from an hour and 15 to an hour and a half, depending on the questions. And usually people have a lot of questions.
Now, is there a place online people can get tickets? How would you go about?
You don't have to actually get tickets if you're not in a big group. There is the phone number on the website, but usually it's just show up at the Capitol prior to 7:30. Get there by about 7:15 or so, and just hang out. And at that point, once we have to have, unfortunately, we have to have a minimum of about six people to actually run a tour. So
if I don't get any type of seeing any ghosts or any crazy stuff, do you guys just go ahead and just make some stuff up for me?
No, we really don't make anything up. No, we try to make sure every story we tell is at least you can look it up and
try and get it a little historical.
Some
accurate.
Sort of. Now, right. I don't say that all these, they all saw these ghosts and that's true, but these are stories that have been passed down, so you could at least
that people have there's at least seen and
there
gone
are
on, yeah.
There's okay. References.
This
we can
is why
back.
I've never been tapped to lead a group. I've been like, oh, the farting ghost again. Yes, Ash, we know.
Yeah, if you smell something ghost. Here in a couple of minutes, it's probably because of that farting ghost. I'm just saying.
The tour is in 4D, by the way.
Yeah.
We do walk past these barking spiders. I don't know if you knew.
Right.
The fourth D stands for dirty. So people can do the tour that's running now through the 31st, and it starts back up again. Mm-hmm. What is the URL for their website?
I'm sorry? I don't know the actual URL, but if you Google Leaking Ghost Walk Springfield, Illinois, I think it might be springfieldwalks.com, because the Garrett Moffat is the gentleman who created the walk, and he does other tours as well through Springfield Walks. So it's a completely independent tour, so it's not owned by the state or anything like that. But he runs several tours, so and that is probably on his the Springfield Walks website. So that's probably the easiest way to get to the information.
And we'll put that address up on the website as well, so that people can connect with that.
Okay.
And as far as your book, obviously out October 1st, where can people get it? Where are people going to be able to? Can they download? Is it going to be an EPUB?
There will be.
Are you looking at like an Amazon
It'll be it'll be available on Amazon, both as paperback and through the Kindle, so ebook. There will be. You can order it from my website as well. It's ericwoodsauthor.com, and also on October 4th, which is a week from this Friday, from 8 to 10 at Van's Coffee House downtown. I'll be holding a book signing that day, so they can get it there if they want to.
And can you go ahead and let individuals know that may be not familiar with Springfield where Vans actually is?
Vans is on 7th Street. It's actually right across the street from the Lincoln Home. And right
it's
next.
Also...
So, yeah, it's right there. It's kind of
directly
little,
next to Obed
little,
and Isaac.
Yeah, right
so
next to Obed and
Isaac. Where that's at.
Yeah, Obed and Isaac, right the that. Lincoln Home, like right by the Hoagland Center for the Arts.
Yep.
A little south of the Capitol area, it's like between 6th and 7th Street.
And as far as being able to follow you personally, not like follow you, like where are you going to be between 9
I mean,
a.m. and 5 p.m.?
He's already giving tours, so maybe we should
people
go
know where
and
to find
tours
me.
Of where
you
can
give out your license plate number. Now, people who would want to follow you, do you have a social media campaign?
I'm all over social media. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Just look up Eric Woods Author, and you should be able to find me. If you go to my website, you can find all that information as well. It's pretty easy to kind of find me on that as well.
Okay, and we will also put all those links, actually, when we have the episode available for download. So people who are listening right now, obviously, it's already available for download. And you should be able to see the links where you downloaded it on the website. That's horror-fix.com. I am Ash Hamilton from horror-fix.com. I've got Chris Pugh, my guest host tonight, and Eric Woods, horror author, who also is with the Springfield Ghost Walk. Thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you
very much. I urge people definitely check out the book, check out the tour if you are local, and we'll see in a little bit. I think next week we're probably going to treat you to Hart Fisher and the American Horrors Film Festival. Cool.